I would like Mr. Robertson to introduce the next item, please, which is an informational item.
Item 7 is an informational item and relates to the use of mitigation funds resulting from the State Water Board's once-through cooling policy associated with PG&E's Diablo Canyon Power Plant. Just a little bit of background here first. State Board's once-through cooling policy requires power plant operators to meet certain flow requirements and to mitigate for loss of marine life caused by the once-through cooling process and the result of entrainment. PG&E is complying with the once-through cooling policy by closing the Diablo Canyon Power Plant in 2024 and 2025. There are two units. And by paying annual mitigation payments until closure, amounting to $3.8 million per year. These annual mitigation payments are managed by the Ocean Protection Council and are used to support the state's marine protected areas on the Central Coast. I believe we have a couple representatives. I want to do a little introduction here. I think we have a couple representatives from the State Water Board here. And they are Julie Johnson and Catherine Fake, I believe. Fike. From the Ocean Standards Unit at the State Water Board. Cindy Dawson with the Ocean Protection Council is here today to provide information on the use of these funds. But before we go there, I'm going to turn over to Michael Thomas, the Assistant Executive Officer, and Michael's going to provide a little brief intro.
Thank you, John. I wanted to just orient the board to a sequence of events that led to Cindy Dawson being here today and making this presentation. And Dr. Hunter is a board member who has history with this item. We worked on the power plants in our region and the once-through cooling issue for many years. We spent enormous resources on it, and the board spent an enormous amount of time on this issue. And in the late 90s and up until 2005, we did a lot of investigative work. We hired a whole bunch of independent scientists and consulting firms to help us. And this is the Diablo Canyon Power Plant. We spent a lot of time on this power plant in particular because it is such a large power plant, and it has a very large once-through cooling water system. It takes in 2.5 billion gallons per day. It takes the water in Intake Cove, which you can see on the screen here, into this structure. Here, this is the intake structure. And when that cooling water is pulled into the power plant, it takes in fish larvae and fish eggs, plankton, and we assume 100% mortality of that marine life. Water circulates through the plant. It's discharged into the discharge cove, which is also called Diablo Cove. These are the two main environmental issues associated with the power plant: the intake of marine plankton and the loss of that marine life, and then the warm water discharge to the cove. That warm water is heated up 22 degrees as it goes through the power plant, cools the power plant, it's elevated to a temperature of 22 degrees, then discharged to the cove. So the loss of marine life and then the biological changes that occur in that cove were our big issues. In 2005, our last board meeting where we talked about this was here in this room. And we recommended to the board that we try to figure out a way to get mitigation funds for the entrainment losses and use those mitigation funds for marine protected areas, to support marine protected areas. But then later in 2005, the State Board announced that they were going to establish their own policy, their own once-through cooling water policy, and they would assume jurisdiction over this issue. So they did start that process in 2005. In 2010, they finished the policy. It took about 5 years. We participated in that policy. We made recommendations all along the way. They included our recommendations for how to do entrainment studies and for how to calculate mitigation and for how to use those mitigation funds. The policy says that the preferred use is support of marine protected areas. So that's good news, and it took this long for it to occur. In January of 2018, this year, the State Board Executive Director approved PG&E's annual payments, and they are about $3.8 million per year and will continue until plant closure. They go back to 2015, so we estimate that the total amount will be around $38 million. It could be between 36 and 39. And that those funds should go to support marine protected areas. And Cindy Dawson is here today to talk about that process.
Great. Thank you, Michael. Good morning, Chair Wolf and board members. I'm very happy to be here today to provide you with an update on California's marine protected areas and then the development of the OP, the Ocean Protection Council, once through cooling at, interim mitigation program. So my name is Cindy Dawson. I'm the State of California Marine Protected Area Policy Advisor and a Senior Program Manager at the Ocean Protection Council. Before I provide you with these updates on the California's Marine Protected Areas and the Once Through Cooling Program, I'd like to actually step back and just talk about the recent history of California's Marine Protected Areas. So we'll go ahead and jump way back to 1999 and talk about the founding legislation, which is the Marine Life Protection Act. And this piece of legislation directed the state to redesign its network of marine protected areas. At the time of the passage of this law, less than 3% of state waters, 0 to 3 nautical miles, were protected. And it was very much a hodgepodge approach. They were very small, they were not ecologically connected, and they were not designed in any holistic manner. So the Marine Life Protection Act recognized the connectivity of ecosystems, both the members within an ecosystem and among different parts along the coast. And so it really took a holistic view of that and directed the state to recognize the structure, function, and integrity of ecosystems and it design and networks that supported that. Supported it by protecting habitats, protecting species, and protecting the relationships among the members of ecosystems. So it was really a paradigm shift in how we had thought about marine protected areas in the state of California previously. So very quickly after the implementation of that Marine Life Protection Act, it became clear to state agencies that there was another kind of hodgepodge in the way that we named marine protected areas. There were over 20 different designations by multiple designating agencies. It was very confusing and essentially untenable moving forward. So there was another piece of legislation called the Marine Managed Areas Improvement Act that streamlined down that list of 20 or so different types of designations. Some of those designations were the exact same level of protection. They just had a different designating entity. And so it was very confusing to the public. And so we streamlined that down to 6. And then it also clearly identified who is going to be designating entities for marine managed areas. Marine protected areas are a subset of that. So it identified the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and their regulatory partner, the Fish and Game Commission, as the primary designating area, entity. It designated the Department of Parks and Recreation, and then it also designated the state board in partnership with regional boards to designate water quality or state water quality protection areas, both a general protection and an area of special biological significance to be in alignment with the program that was you all started back in the 70s. So now that we had some clear direction and some clear goals set out, the state embarked in a multi-year process that was science-based and stakeholder-driven. It was phased regionally, and we finished our network in December of 2012. We have 124 marine protected areas across the state. Our network is primarily made up of two types of marine protected areas. State marine reserves, which you'll see on the map in red, they prevent all take. Any kind of take at all is a state marine reserve. And then we have state marine conservation areas, which are site-based regulations. So for instance, maybe you could fish for a transient species like salmon, but you can't fish on the bottom. There are other types of designations, but those are the primary components of our network of 124 MPAs. It corresponds to about 16% of state waters. 9% of that is state marine reserves, which is the highest level of protection. I also want to just call out, in the Northern Channel Islands, there was a federal process, a concurrent federal process that actually designated and extended the state MPAs. So in the Northern Channel Islands, we have MPAs that extend past state waters out into federal waters in the northern area. And we're going to actually talk about some results that we have from some work out of UC Santa Barbara out of the Northern Channel Islands to give us an indication of how these MPAs may be performing. So marine protected areas as a management tool have at this point been used widely for over a couple decades now. And what has emerged as a consensus from that experience is that you need to have a strong and active management program for your marine protected areas to accrue their maximum ecological benefits. So if MPAs are going to work, you need to have a strong management program, and that's exactly what we've developed in California. And the four key elements, again, from this consensus experience of several decades across the globe, is that you need to have outreach and education. Stakeholders need to understand and value marine protected areas. You need to have research and monitoring that will allow you to evaluate the performance of your network at meeting their goals, and then also inform adaptive management of that network. You need to have enforcement and compliance. So the rules on the books need to be enforced, and stakeholders need to comply with those. And then you also need to have coordinated policy and permitting. I mentioned earlier how there was a hodgepodge of naming and multiple agencies that designated marine protected areas prior to the Marine Managed Area Improvement Act and the Marine Life Protection Act. So in an effort to ensure that we had coordinated decision moving forward, the Secretary of Natural Resources tasked the Ocean Protection Council with convening a marine protected area statewide leadership team. That leadership team is made up of the core designating agencies, including the state board, and then has also other agencies that have overlapping mandates and jurisdiction, coastal commissions, state lands, other folks that are involved in coastal management in the state. So we meet regularly as an advisory body to ensure that decision-making around marine protected areas is coordinated and it's collaborative across the state agencies, bringing their various mandates and jurisdictions together to make sure of that. So let's talk about a couple of key attributes of California's marine protected areas that make our network particularly unique. So the cartoon you see up there recognizes something that water boards know very well, is this interconnectedness between land and sea, the land-sea interface. And our Marine Life Protection Act really focuses on ecosystems and protecting the whole ecosystem, including water quality being a key component of that. And so the network that was designed in California was designed to recognize that connectivity and also the connectivity along the coastline, so the ecological connectivity of eggs and larvae and individuals. And our network was designed to retain those eggs, larvae, and individuals within the boundaries of MPAs, but also was designed to export those to other MPAs and to the spaces in between. So when I think of California's MPA network, I'm not only talking about the 124 boxers, it's our whole coastline.
So,
absolutely.
Because it'll help me frame this. I got three quick questions, and some of them I should probably know the answer, but I don't. What's the international water boundary?
200 miles.
200 miles?
Is our exclusive economic zone.
Okay.
And then state waters is 0 to 3 nautical miles. Federal waters extend out to 12 nautical miles.
All right. So Regional Water Quality Control Board, 3 miles?
Yes.
And then Coastal Commission, that's my last question.
Same. State jurisdiction, 0 to 3 nautical miles.
Okay. Just wanted to kind of lay the boundaries so I understand.
I mean, Coastal Commission's jurisdiction is more bounded by coastal development. State lands is in charge of the subtidal lands. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, when you talk about state jurisdiction, 0 to 3 nautical miles is a safe bet.
Thank you for the clarification.
Absolutely. So we talked about how our Marine Life Protection Act really emphasizes this idea of ecosystems. And I want to talk about one of the effects that we know from data around the world that MPAs can provide, which is allow individuals to grow older and bigger. If we look on the slide here, we'll see a beautiful vermilion rockfish. And if we start on the left-hand side, so we have about a 14-inch individual. That individual, when it reproduces about 150,000 eggs, which sounds like a lot, but a very infinitesimal amount of those will make it to adulthood to reproduce. So if we not even double the size of that fish and take it up to about 23 inches, that same individual will produce 1.7 million eggs and larvae. So you can see that our MPA network removes or reduces fishing. So you can imagine that would allow individuals, fish and invertebrates, and this holds true for many invertebrates like lobster, that larger individuals produce, larger and older individuals produce many more, exponentially more young. So it really can affect how an ecosystem functions and the stability of that ecosystem if you remove a stressor like fishing, which our MPA network does. So now we've heard a little bit about our MPA network, how we got what we have, and what makes our MPA network special. And we heard a little bit about why older and bigger matters. So let's look at some actual results from California's MPA networks. We have results from all the regions, but I'm actually going to just focus on the Northern Channel Island due to time today. And these results are from Dr. Jen Cassell at UC Santa Barbara. She's part of the Partnership for Interdisciplinary Studies of Coastal Oceans. She generously shared her data with me, and this is based on about 10 years of protection in the Northern Channel Islands. Those Northern Channel Islands marine protected areas went in earlier than some of the other regions. They've been in place since 2003. And so when Dr. Cassell looked at fish species, so species that are commonly caught either recreationally or commercially, inside MPAs, and then she compared them to outside MPAs, what she found is that if we start at the upper left here, she found that there are more fish in the same given area in a marine protected area when compared to a similar area outside. And perhaps more importantly, not only are there more, but they're bigger, so the biomass is larger inside the MPAs when compared to outside. So you can also see that represented on the graph in the upper right there. You can see that green line represents inside MPAs, and that blue line represents outside MPAs. It's also just interesting to note, so non-targeted species, which we wouldn't necessarily expect to have an MPA effect, kind of track equally inside and out with a few little bumps here and there. But I think the key take-home here is that upper right, where you can see that there is a significant difference between the inside and outside, and not only the density, but the biomass, the size of those fish are bigger. Yes?
So I'm just to satisfy my curiosity, I can see the trend is going up, mm-hmm. but I also know that data points over time are up and down. Mm-hmm. And is there some understanding behind that, or is that expected?
It's absolutely expected, just the dynamism of the system. It's a very dynamic system, and there's a lot of noise in ecology just generally. I think you guys are familiar with that. But the trend, as you said, you picked out the salient point, which is the trend is going upward. And so that noise is to be expected, and frankly, that noise may become even noisier with climate change impacts. We're still trying to understand if the resilience of these systems can be improved by marine protected areas. The jury is still out on that, but early indications are that they may provide some more resilience because they were a healthier ecosystem to start. So we're still collecting data on that.
So to dovetail, and if you don't mind, because there's a lot of material.
Absolutely.
I think,
absolutely.
You know, that way this is not a monologue.
Yep.
The scientists have maps that also show, for example, seawater temperature, because with the El Nino, La Ninas, et cetera, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, we actually had barracuda sightings.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Which typically they stay mm-hmm. further south.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's probably part of that background noise, as you call it, is seawater temperature.
That's exactly right. So the noise that I spoke of that Dr. Hunter pointed out, some of the explanations for those types of noise are these naturally occurring shifts in sort of oceanographic regimes. So there's cold water times, there's warm water times. I will say that our understanding of that is changing as we see climate impacts, and these sort of decadal shifts maybe are changing. They're becoming more frequent. They're becoming more extreme. We're still trying to understand that, but absolutely. There are a lot of factors that drive populations one way or another. One of the things that we really try to control in our monitoring is comparing similar areas. So areas that have similar oceanographic regimes, similar exposures, similar bathymetry, similar rugosity on the bottom, so that we can try to tease out if this is an MPA effect or it's being driven by something else. And it's complex out there, but we feel confident in this data. And, as I said, this is a result from the Channel Islands. We have similar results in Point Lobos up north, in way north, and we have a Cabrillo up north that's been a longer time. So the trends, the take home is the early results and the trends are positive in us meeting the goals of the Marine Life Protection Act. All right, so a quick little cartoon slide to make sure everybody's awake. So I'd like us to take this into the next section here where I'm gonna talk to you about the Once Through Cooling Program. What we know about marine protected areas is that people have to understand them and value them and comply with regulations. So that's a key component. Regardless of how well or scientifically designed the MPAs themselves are, if people don't understand and comply with the regulations, they can't work or they can't achieve their full complement of ecological benefits. We also know they need to be enforced. The laws on the books need to be enforced. Again, ensuring that stressor is reduced or removed in these areas. And then the final thing is that the MPAs need to themselves be designed and maintained in a way that support the healthy diversity and the healthy habitats. So it's not only that you need to protect a habitat, you need to protect that habitat, but you need to protect the relationships between the different types of species in an ecosystem, right? So you need the primary producers, you need the grazers, you need the predators, you need everybody to be present, and you need to protect those relationships and those functions and processes within the ecosystem. And that's what our MPAs are designed to do. And that's what the Once Through Cooling Program is going to do and support these three main things. So we're going to come back to them in a second as we move into the Once Through Cooling section here. Okay, so Michael teed this up really well, so I'm not going to spend too much time on this. We do have a policy in place that the mitigation projects are directed toward increases in marine life associated with the state's marine protected areas in the geographic region of the facility. So there's a lot in there, and we've been working with a group of expert scientists to unpack that, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. And then I just want to talk about that there was a following MOU that talked about how the funds would be allocated among both the Ocean Protection Council and the Coastal Conservancy. So the money that comes in each year, $5.4 million, which was based on an economic analysis for the cost of the Marine Protected Area Program, $5.4 million of those funds will go to the Ocean Protection Council to be administered to support marine protected areas. And then any additional funds that come in that year will go to the Coastal Conservancy directed at wetland restoration. And not that wetland restoration wouldn't necessarily be part of the OPC thing. It would just be more designated to the type of work the Coastal Conservancy does as well. So. All right, so again, Michael set me up here with, he already talked about, and you are all well familiar with the impacts of Once Through Cooling in impingement. which can trap those larger, more mature individuals. So that could be a big hit to populations, right? And then entrainment, eggs, larvae, smaller individuals. I don't need to tell you anything you don't already know. But I did want to put this slide up just to emphasize that these impacts are essentially a reproductive impact. It's a direct line, right? It significantly affects the reproductive potential of a population once through cooling impacts. And what I just talked to you about is that marine protected areas can also directly impact in an opposite direction the reproductive potential of a population. So that's the key point, is that once through cooling is a reproductive impact, and we know from data around the world and data from our own MPA network that MPAs can positively affect the reproductive output of a population. Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty of how we're going to do this. So the power plant interim mitigation annual payment comes in. $5.4 million goes to the Ocean Protection Council. The balance goes to the Coastal Conservancy. So we have designated essentially three big buckets, which you saw that cartoon a little bit earlier, emphasizing why those buckets were chosen to implement the policy as directed. So the first one is restoration projects and research to understand what degree the existing MPAs may be mitigating for the reproductive impacts of once through cooling. So we need to understand, if we are getting these reproductive benefits from MPAs, how much is that offsetting what the impact of once through cooling? And then also, are there well-proven, well-vetted restoration projects that not only are in coastal wetlands or salt marshes, but even on the open coast, that can increase marine life as directed in the policy. So we need to improve compliance. We need to make sure people are following the rules, and that goes to outreach and education. And we can get very, very big value-added benefits for education about marine protected areas because we bring in all aspects. We talk about water quality. We talk about the importance of ecosystems. So that's a great one that we think is critical to ensuring that we can increase marine life in the marine protected areas. And then, obviously, the more easy one is to improve enforcement. So, yeah, absolutely.
So in the education and outreach, mm-hmm. One of the things that I experience in my work, I worked on coast and ocean issues in these four coastal counties, mm-hmm. From San Mateo to Santa Barbara. And one of the things that was very apparent to me was the understanding of coastal confluent streams and water quality efforts and river restoration, fresh water work going on, and the impacts or the benefits to the near shore, mm-hmm. marine tidal zone. Is that a dimension of your education and outreach? Because it just seems that the groups that are Friends of the River and those kinds of land-based groups, mm-hmm. have very little awareness of how their work is actually integrated, yeah. with goals for marine habitat protection and those benefits. And just seems to me that there's so few opportunities to make those connections.
I agree with everything you said. And one of the ways that we're trying to address that is there are the coastal state parks are co-located with 33% of the marine protected area, and an even higher percentage in Southern California. And so one of the ways that we're going to make sure that we have not only the story about inland and water quality, but connecting it out to the coast, is we're working with parks now to spend some of this money on engaging their docents, engaging their trained interpreters to actually tell that story that you just outlined. So we're really excited to be engaging with the Department of Parks, and we're really think this money provides an opportunity, sort of a missed opportunity that's kind of been sitting there for a long time, and this is a way to actually take tangible action on that. So absolutely agree. Great. Okay. So I just wanted to go into the timeline we have moving forward. Actually, let me just bump quick back here. So since I talked about parks, I did want to make sure that I talk about the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, Law Enforcement Marine Division. We're also working with them on a 3-year work plan to make tangible improvements in patrol hours within the marine protected areas. And so we know that we have some problems, especially in the Southern California Bight. There are some hot spots that have been a challenge as far as enforcement goes. And so we're working on a discrete plan that has measurable effectiveness monitoring to ensure that we're actually improving enforcement in the Southern California Bight, but also up here in the Central Coast, in the southern part of the Central Coast. We feel like the area of impact extends north about 100 kilometers and south about 100 kilometers of Diablo, and so that kind of work will also be focused in that area as well. Yeah.
And I had a kind of a follow-up quick question to Dr. Hunter, you know, the educational component. Mm-hmm. You know, we hear more and more about the issues of, you know, plastics, et cetera, which are discharged into the ocean. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a few compelling videos on that. So when Dr. Hunter was talking about Friends of the River and these different efforts, I mean, this is a big issue. You talked about Southern California when you have, you know, the first storms. It's a pretty sad picture.
Yeah.
Outside, and this certainly impact marine life in significantly. Is there a component in your work associated with this and kind of help address the issue? I know at the water board, state water board level, you know, there's efforts done to require municipalities to have, you know, increased attention in regard to, you know, garbage flowing into the ocean. And in fact, at some of our annual meetings, we've seen some pictures that were quite compelling. So could you comment on that?
Absolutely. So a couple of things in that arena. So more broadly at the Ocean Protection Council, we have a program specifically on marine debris. We just updated the state's trash approach for marine debris. And so those are sort of at the high level, specifically in the Once Through Cooling program. When we were looking about ways to make the biggest impact with the outreach and education component, not just for MPAs, but everything that's part of MPAs, water quality, including marine debris and trash and plastic and all that, we actually really looked at the demographics of the visitation to state parks, and we felt for a lot of different reasons, and I would also like to mention that state parks is really expanding their online program, which is called Ports. And it brings kids that may not be able to travel to a state park actually out to the state park. It's live streaming, and kids can ask questions. We have one up in Point Lobos where somebody's out on a paddle board, and they stick a GoPro in the water, and kids can see what it looks like underwater and ask questions about that. And so we felt that investing in parks to bring that message, not just about water quality, not just about MPAs, but everything that goes into making an ecosystem healthy, really was the best bang for the stakes buck. And so that's certainly a component of the education that Parks does. And so that even if certainly the visitors can take that back to wherever they're from, and often visitors to state parks aren't local folks. They're inland folks or they're folks from other parts of the state. And so it's a really good match of really trying to expand the impact and the penetration of that message that you just said, because it's such a big problem. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A quick and easy one. You mentioned we have 124 marine protected areas in the state. How many do we have in our region? Do you happen to know that number?
You're going to ask me a tough one, huh?
I thought that was an easy one.
I can get back to you on that. I think it's, I don't know off the top of my head. Maybe Tova can look that up while I'm talking, and I can get back to you by the end.
Okay. That's good.
All right, so let's march through this timeline. So we had this approach that I just outlined for you. It was endorsed and supported by the Ocean Protection Council back in November 2017 at their meeting. And right off the heels of that, what we understood is that policy language that talked about increasing marine life in the geographic region of the facility and associated with MPAs had a lot packed in there and a lot of science questions packed in there. What do all of those things mean? What does it mean to increase marine life associated with the state's MPAs? And so we brought together some members of our Ocean Protection Council Science Advisory Team, and then they reached out to other experts. So the co-chairs of this science advisory team, maybe names you are familiar with, Dr. Richard Ambrose from UCLA and Dr. Pete Raimondi from UC Santa Cruz, they filled out their team with experts in oceanography, experts in larval transport and larval behavior, nearshore ecologists, to really define specifically, based on the best available science, what those things really mean. And also to look at some really commonly used restoration approaches and aggregate the best science so we understand what the likelihood of some of these techniques are at increasing marine life associated with the marine protected areas. So that panel is wrapping up their work. It's been an incredible process working with this incredible, incredibly impressive group of scientists. They've been very generous with their time, very engaged. And that report will be out the end of this month, beginning of June. And we will use that as the foundation to build our grant guidelines off of that. So we envision a grant, a competitive grant process later this year. In preparation of that, the grant guidelines will have an extended public comment period. We also plan to hold regional workshops to get feedback on those grant guidelines. And then we plan to bring those grant guidelines both to the Fish and Game Commission and our Ocean Protection Council in October of this year. Very quickly after that, a lot of work is going to be happening concurrently. That we plan to release that competitive call later in November. So we give people plenty of time to apply for that, but we also try to make a decision early in the year so that folks that are doing field projects can get ready and be ready in the spring for their field work if their projects are approved. So we're really excited about the program. We've had a lot of help, a lot of coordination with the state board. We're always excited to hear from the regional boards as well. Any thoughts you have as this process proceeds? We think we're well-grounded in the best available science, and we think we are set up to be very successful in implementing this policy to increase marine life in the state's marine protected areas. So we're going to have a focus. This first round will be just for restoration projects. And then future rounds, and we're going to have to work out with our partners the allocation among sort of enforcement, education, and restoration. Future rounds will be the entire 5.4 will be competitive. In this initial round, due to funding limitations and some known needs in outreach and education and enforcement, we put some multi-year funding into that, and then a little smaller round of restoration for the first round, but eventually that next year, the whole 5.4 will be in a competitive program. So we're really focused on funding restoration projects that are scientifically proven to increase marine life. There is space in there for research and design, but it has to be scientifically sound and scoped appropriately if it's a pilot project and we're trying to understand new methods. And then, you know, we're going to continue to identify opportunities to improve enforcement and compliance. And all this is leading us to put the state's marine protected areas in the best position to accrue their maximum ecological benefits. I just want to take a quick second to introduce Tova Handelman here. She is a new hire with the Ocean Protection Council. She's a new program manager, and she will be leading up our once through cooling work. We'll be working on that together, but Tova will be the lead, and then my contact information as well. And I will close with the number in your region here. So from San Mateo to Point Conception, there's 29 marine protected areas, 13 in the Channel Islands, and 18% of the Central Coast in some kind of MPA. And I will say to everybody, if you just Google MPA statistics, the CDFW page will come up. And if you scroll all to the bottom, you'll see the statewide statistics there that I should have memorized but don't. great. So I'll take any questions you may have. And thank you so much for your attention.
So we had our vetting process here with Jane. A quick question. In the funding that you outlined, is there any monies that would be set aside in, I'll call it a trust, where it basically provides long-term monies available by putting the funds in an interest-bearing investment trust, and then being able, therefore, to stretch the benefits? Is that even legal within your...
No, it's not.
Well, that was
that's a
quick answer.
That's a great idea, and that would be a wonderful thing to do. But we have typical state restrictions on funding. So we have a year to encumber and 2 years to spend. So when that fiscal year clock happens, July 1, assuming the budget is signed, that year's funds, that has to be encumbered. It can be spent over multiple years, but it can only, you got 3 years total, essentially. 1 year to encumber, 1 year. So we're very strategic and aware of that, and we think we've come up with good ways to kind of space that out and get the maximum benefit. But yours would work better, but we can't do that.
So tying to that question, and often I refer to it as the money multiplier, where let's say you receive $250,000 grant and then you can use that as a matching grant for more funding, and then you bundle these different grants and you can then attack bigger projects rather than singly use the monies for a specific project without benefiting the supplemental aspect of other grants. Is that something you do
regularly?
Yeah,
so we, I anticipate, and we're still in development, and then there's going to be a public comment process on this. I anticipate there being probably some bonus points for leveraging in the grant guidelines. So when grants are scored out, if you have a higher percentage of leveraging, and you can bring that to the project, that your project would score better in the competitive peer review process. That's always something we try to include for all the reasons that you just said, because it makes a lot of sense for a lot of different reasons.
Thank you. Let's see. Mr. Johnston.
So just to be sure I understand, the whole set of funding cycles you were laying out are based on the $5.3 million from PG&E from the Diablo Canyon?
No. That's from multiple power plants. So I was speaking about the larger program. So the 5.4 is all the payments. Diablo only comes in around $3 million. So the additional payments come in from other power plants that are part of the program in the Southern California Bight. Obviously, the funds related to Diablo will be focused in the Central Coast area.
So that was my question. So a little over half of the 5.4 is coming over out of Diablo.
Correct.
And is there a how are you doing a geographic nexus, or to what extent are you doing a geographic nexus?
So if you look on the screen, this is hot off the presses from the Once Through Cooling Working Group. And the Once Through Cooling Group evaluated several models to determine the area of impact for the power plants. Back earlier in the slides, there was the state of California, and you saw the power plants up and down. There's 10 power plants that are part of this, one of them, of course, being Diablo. They evaluated several models, including newer regional oceanographic modeling about the connectivity and area of impact of of Once Through Cooling. They actually decided to use the ETM model that you all use to determine area of impact. So that's what you see reflected here. And so the area of impact for Diablo is about 100 kilometers north and 100 kilometers south. as we spend funds, you know, where the funds come from and those area of impacts will obviously be taken into account when projects are awarded.
So when you say it'll be taken into account, mm-hmm. I mean, does that mean that the little over 50% of the funding that's coming out of Diablo Canyon will be spent in that 100 kilometers north, 100 kilometers south approximately area? Or does that just mean that it weights the scoring of the grants?
So the grant guidelines aren't done, and we'll, as I said, there'll be a public comment period for that. But what I anticipate is that for restoration projects, I think that they will occur at, you know, related to the amount of money in the area of impact. I think for outreach and education and enforcement, there's strong cases to be made that there are impacts to the Diablo area that can be made in outreach and education and enforcement that isn't directly in that 100 and 200 kilometers. I will say for restoration projects, though, I would anticipate, and again, the grant guidelines aren't done, to be exactly what you said. It be connected to the amount of money.
Okay, I'm not trying to sound grabby, but I'm assuming that the amount of money is related to the amount of impact, the amount of gallonage, et cetera.
Yes, so the singular nuclear power plant now we have operating vastly outshadows any other intakes.
And I saw on the map that some plants are closing earlier, some plants are closing
Correct.
Later to deal with this. So I assume that mix will change of money and of grant allocation as time goes on.
Yes, so we expect diminishing returns. We can model those returns based on the compliance dates, but as you point out, some are coming into compliance early. And so this amount of money will get smaller and smaller every year, and it could get smaller sooner than we think if someone decides to go offline sooner than their compliance date, which some already have.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I understand that the process for the grant guidelines is still in play, and sounds like a lot broad range of views and perspectives and priorities are going into that mm-hmm. process effort. So typically restoration project will carry some portion of the work to address education and outreach. Mm-hmm. Do you envision any grants being issued solely to address education and outreach that are maybe more broadly, more general in nature, but or maybe tied to like the sanctuary programs or groups that are already engaged with public education only and they're not actually doing restoration?
Absolutely. So the initial investment with parks is an example of that. But as we move into this fully competitive process, not this year, but in 2019, I absolutely envision a section of some allocation of those funds being directed solely at outreach. And that's going to be open to folks who are engaged in that space. We have MPA collaboratives that are essentially county-based groups of experts mm-hmm. That agencies, local fishermen, other folks who are just really familiar with their area of the coast, those people know where the gaps are in education mm-hmm. better than anyone else. And so, you know, those groups would be able to apply, other local nonprofits. And I think there's strong evidence to support that, yes, of course, we want to talk about the value of MPAs and why we have MPAs, but the way our MPAs were designed wraps our arms around all those other important things, water quality, you know, trash, those types of things. So when somebody comes, I think the grant guidelines associated with that are going to reflect that ability that, yes, MPAs need to be that priority, but we need to hit this whole holistic ecosystem idea, and I think that those types of groups absolutely would be eligible.
That's really good to hear, and I understand that, you know, in the early stages of that, I can just share with you that the water quality issue is very controversial, and I often ran into walls being a person in the room, you know, talking about water quality. And so I'm really pleased to hear that, you know, those days and those efforts, you know, have led into a broader, absolutely, more holistic understanding, and that's really good. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It was extremely informative. And I just had a detailed question related to communication and outreach. And I would presume that there'd be some focus on environmental justice issues and disadvantaged community issues related to maybe even a portion of that funding being allocated for those populations in communication outreach as you develop the guidelines. Just wanted to...
Yeah, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but... disadvantaged communities, they've been keeping track of that in the ports program and parks, and that's one of the reasons it was so attractive as an initial step, not the only step, but an initial step in sort of addressing these underserved communities and bringing that type of experience and education, even if they can't make it to the park and there aren't funds for buses or whatever. So I imagine that thread to continue, absolutely. I mean, it's something we're committed to, and again, I think it's something that we can reflect in the grant guidelines we build for that section, that either bonus points or just, you know, initial points given to a program that addresses a needs in underserved communities.
Or even just a small percentage of that funding going directly to disadvantaged communities.
Absolutely.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And is there a formal feedback process of recommendations for projects that can be made by the dischargers themselves, of course excluding projects which would have direct mitigation benefit within, you know, the narrow scope of a discharge point. But, you know, some of the large utilities, you know, do have marine scientists and fishery biologists on board and may have, you know, some suggestions because they're pretty close to, you know, their own projects.
I think I might kick that to Kat. My understanding of it is that they had the opportunity to propose those at the beginning, and if they didn't, then they paid the fees. Is that right?
Hi, Catherine Fike, State Water Board and the Division of Water Quality, the acting Ocean Unit Chief. So in the once through cooling policy, there were three opportunities for the power plants to come into compliance with the interim mitigation requirements. One was to create their own mitigation project. Another was to credit based off of existing mitigation that they've done. That would have involved like an intensive review to make sure it was actually appropriate for that crediting. And then the other was to provide funding to the Ocean Protection Council and the Coastal Conservancy. All 10 went forward with providing at least partial compliance with providing funding to the Coastal Conservancy and the Ocean Protection Council. We had a couple of cases. I think it was primarily Huntington Beach. We had a partial credit for an existing mitigation project.
So in the case within our Central Coast region, there hasn't been any proposed projects?
Not by the specific power plants themselves in accordance with the OTC policy.
All right. Thank you for that clarification. So any further question? And we do have one speaker card from Mr. Schimmick, but it says, only if necessary. So, not necessary? All right. I'd like also to, you know, give the opportunity to Mr. Robertson or staff, you know, to comment or provide additional input on the presentation.
First, I would like to thank both the State Water Board staff and Cindy for coming down and also providing the presentation. Thank you. Very informative from us. Michael, do you have anything you want to add to?
I'd just like to thank, I wish Jeff Young were here. I'm glad that Dr. Hunter is here. Jeff Young also has history with this. And I mentioned that the last time we talked about this was 2005 in this room. We had quite a lively workshop on this, and Dr. Hunter and Mr. Young were two of the board members that challenged us to find a way to mitigate these impacts. And I'm happy that we're able to report that we did.
That was probably the meeting where he destroyed my timer.
Yeah, could have.
So any further question or comment? So likewise, want to thank you for giving us a good overview. And what's going to be the formal mechanism for our regional board to, you know, get updates on the progress that's being made?
Well, I think through time, what we should do is just keep contact with Cindy and talk. Maybe periodically she can come back or staff can come back and inform us about the types of projects that have been selected, you know, as we look forward in what she laid out, the types of projects that were selected, ultimately what those projects resulted in the case of restoration projects, or to some of the specifics about education, what was achieved there to reflect back out on the projects.
All right. Thank you. So thank you, ladies. Appreciate very much. So at this time, perhaps we could move to the next item and then take a break and close session. What's your pleasure?
Well, we haven't. Roughly a 90-minute, I think, closed session. We could start that. Yeah. So, right. So I think what we could do is we could break right now, go to closed session, and then include lunch with that. We'll just do public.
Okay. Yeah, and public comment after that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, we'll come back at, we can come back at 1:10?
Yeah, we come back at 1:10, and then immediately thereafter, public comment that way. Why not?
Public, on the agenda, public comments, it's not before 1:30.
Okay, so. 20 minutes later.
Okay.
We'll see where we get there, yeah.
Got it.
All right, so we're going to take a recess now, and 10 after 1, we'll get back.
For the record, we'll be discussing in closed session deliberation whether to initiate litigation.